So the very first speaker is Dr. Jason Lambert from the Environmental Protection Agency. Dr. Lambert received his bachelor degree from Western Kentucky University in the area of recombinant genetics and chemistry. He went on to receive his master's and his PhD in pharmacology and toxicology from the University of Louisville, where he studied with James King on the effects of zinc on liver protection. He went on to do a postdoc at the EPA with John Lipscomb, working to make sure that we were all drinking very clean water. And at that time, he also became a diplomat of the American Board of Toxicology and is actively involved in the societies for toxicology and for risk analysis. He worked at the EPA as a chemical manager focusing on health risk assessments that are of national interest. And he has many awards, but I have to point out the one that sounded really fun to me, I was just talking to him about it, is his military experience. And I'm sure it wouldn't be in his presentation otherwise, so I had to mention that he was on the 11th Special Forces Group Airborne and 20th Special Forces Group also Airborne. So here on ground is Dr. Lambert.
Okay, first lesson about working in the government is you always have to use a disclaimer. Whether you, no matter how much you believe in what you're saying, you have to say this, that it's your own opinion so that you don't misrepresent those for whom you work. And in this case, it's the Environmental Protection Agency. So the only reason I put this up is that picture was taken in 1992, just before we did a jump on Fort Knox, Kentucky, for a joint exercise with the Armored Division. And the only reason I show that is how in the world do you go from there in 1992 to there in 2008, basically where I'm at this point. So in contrast to some of the presentations you've seen in the other auditorium and maybe in here earlier, what I'm going to do is tell you how I got here first, and then I'm going to follow up with what is it I do for the EPA. So kind of a circuit, you know, I'll say a route that is a little less the road not taken. Lisa Ann Parker just was talking about this. Basically, let me get to the point. I met a girl. And I was pretty much anchored to a specific region in Kentucky, and so I couldn't move about as much as I would like for academic pursuit. So I went to Elizabethtown Community College. I was interested in biology and chemistry, but during that time, I had it in my mind that I was going to be a physician assistant. And I actually found out about, is it Tribeca Nazarene that's down here in Nashville? They have one of the few programs within this region back during those days. So I was convinced that's what I was going to do for a living, except I found out that on the order of, say, 200 to 300 people apply, and usually there's only 30 to 40 slots. So very competitive. Not that that discouraged me from what I was the track I was going on, but if you recall, for those of you that were at Dr. Hazeltine's talk this morning, the keynote speaker, is that look for the long-range goals. So the pile of firecrackers, and then he had the single firecrackers lined up, which were the interim goals. So even back in those days, even when I was getting started in my undergraduate endeavors, I had goals in sight, and I knew some of the short-term goals I needed to try and set up for myself to get where I wanted to go under the assumption I was going to be a PA someday. Well, that didn't work out. So unfortunately, in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, you can't do very much with biology and chemistry degree. So what do? I go down to Western. Well, about an hour up the road on 65 to Western Kentucky University, and I enrolled in there for 2 years and got a Bachelor's of Science where I focused on recombinant genetics and chemistry. I also worked as a lab tech in the molecular biology lab. Once again, in the Commonwealth, you can't do much with that degree. So not that I wasn't looking, there just wasn't much out there. So I ended up, and not that I settled for going for a postgraduate degree, but that I knew that the original goal that I had set for myself was that I wanted to help people. So thus the PA track. I didn't want to go to med school and be on call at 3 a.m. because, you know, Mrs. Roberts was having her child that morning. So I thought, okay, let me go a different route. Maybe I can help people through a biomedical science degree. So I went to Louisville, Pharm and Tox, and I got my master's and PhD there. Now, one thing that I'm going to try and drive into you are some of the themes that you've already heard in many of the talks already throughout the day today, is that it's not so much the fundamental concepts and principles that you learn in your courses here at Vanderbilt or wherever you go to school, but rather it is the critical thinking that you develop in conducting research in the lab, and then being able to... do we have a pointer? Is this a pointer? No. It's okay. I'll just point. So the research in toxicology, the reason I highlight that is... Oh, thank you. Thank you. This is very critical because, you know, you go to class, and to be honest with you, a GPA is very important for some, but to land a job, they're more interested about your ability to come up with ideas, to plan those ideas, and then execute a plan to see if those ideas worked or not. The only way that they know about that is if you publish, okay? So this is my personal opinion, I would say that more so than any GPA is the importance of communicating your thoughts to your peers in the scientific community. Also, and these are some of the things that I really focused on during my graduate school career, even before I did a postdoc at the same institution. I also recognize the importance of communicating the ideas via other formats, not just publications, but through doing poster sessions, being parts of student symposia, and even reaching out. I had no inkling of what, you know, a mutagenic carcinogen was in 1993. But by 2000, I had a Young Investigator Grant Award for looking at cancer in the liver. And the important part of that is that you need to be willing to kind of stretch beyond your comfort zone when you're looking at various pathways of research. Local seminar series, not just home departments. So one of the big things I saw is that we had a weekly Pharm Tox seminar series, and you know, one of the students would get up and they give a 15-20 minute talk on the research in their respective labs, and I noticed that the crowd was always the same there, but that when I would go to a different department and attend something that looked interesting, I didn't see a single other student from my department going to those talks. And the reason I bring that up is it's really important to network. And Lee Sam Parker, I don't know how many of you all were just in the previous talk, but something that many of the speakers have talked about today is networking. And I'm not talking about just peer-to-peer, student-to-student. I'm talking about going up to an investigator and saying, hey, that was a really neat talk. Is there a possibility we could collaborate on something? Of course, in coordination with your mentor. But it's really important to reach out when you can. Now, so at Western, I was a gene jockey, recombinant genetics. Basically, I was just trying to look at recombinant protein expression in prokaryotic cell types. But when I went on to University of Louisville, I was interested in trying to take this type of technology and applying it to getting what I wanted in an in vivo animal system. But where I first got my start is in vitro cardiomyocyte cultures. So I started in heart. Well, it's because my mentor had a heart grant. But ultimately what happened is that what we found out was this interrelationship between what's good for your heart is bad for your liver and vice versa. Very interesting. So I ended up being a liver guy. The only reason I bring this up is because of the transition into the relevance to what I'm doing now. So as I moved in my graduate school career, is that in moving from, you know, prokaryotic protein expression to expression of recombinant proteins in animals and looking at the protective effects of various proteins like metallothionein in the liver, for instance, against toxic insults like ethanol exposure. But what I learned was a whole lot about the relationship between genotype and phenotype, okay? Both the epigenetic changes in signaling and also basically, you know, the tissue architecture related to changes in expression. So this takes us up to about 2002. I did my PhD from 98 to 2002. At that time, I was still anchored because of a girl to Louisville. So I decided to do my first postdoc in at U of L, an academic postdoc. Now, what happened was a gentleman who's interested in ethanol exposure and liver injury said, hey, why don't you come do a postdoc with me? And it seemed like a good fit, so that's what I did. Now, during the course of 2003 to 2004, I was asked to come up with an idea on which we could write grants that would then feed into a greater R01 grant application. So during that time, I dreamt up an idea about a protein, using protein overexpression in the intestinal tract to protect against liver injury due to ethanol exposure. So I'm not going to lie to you, love my beer, love my bourbon. So what better endeavor than to put something into those drinks that would protect me from liver injury from consuming those things? So so you could pray it's, yeah, I'm gold mine. So basically, during that time, I was looking at, I thought, okay, intestinal trefoil factor, not many people pay attention to this. I screened the data through PubMed, not a whole lot of people thinking about this. Wrote a grant, got a grant. It was related to the cancer aspects, but the basic gist was is this: during this time, my long-term goal then became I'm going to use this type of data, this type of project to establish myself as an assistant professor, hopefully, a tenure track, whether it was U of L, UK, wherever, even Vandy maybe. But I was convinced no one was thinking on these lines. And what I mean by that is that what I found was that liver injury was related to bacterial cell wall products that leak into the portal blood flow from the intestines, and it drains into the liver. You get an inflammatory response and significant liver injury. Ethanol potentiates this effect by reducing the intestinal permeability in the small and large intestine. So I was going to try and protect the intestine and protect the liver. No one could be thinking about this, especially the aspect where I was going to recombinantly express trefoil factor in lactobacillus. Okay, so instead of Jamie Lee Curtis doing the Activia commercials, I was hoping I would be up there saying, drink my beer and you're great. So what happened was is that in the summer of 2004, I had my short-term goals laid out. I had my long-term goal laid out. My mentor, my postdoc mentor, comes up and he goes, Jason, we need to talk. And it's never good, right? He shuts the door to his office and what I do. He lays a paper in my lap, published in Gastroenterology. At that time, the impact factor of gastro was about 13. So a lot of people were reading that. You would not believe what the title was. Exactly what I had proposed in my research. No one in the world could be thinking about it. But a collaboration between two groups in England and the Netherlands thought about it and published it exactly almost to the cross T and the dotted I of what I was thinking about. I was dead in the water. So at that time, fortunately, because of previous networking through Society of Toxicology and the Ohio Valley chapter of SOT, wow, that didn't show up good. I received a phone call. I don't know if this was serendipity or if my postdoc mentor gave a call to, you know, a mutual friend and said, hey, Jason's dead in the water, can you help him out? But I got a phone call in August of 2004 and said, hey, Jason, this is John Lipscomb. You ever thought about doing something different? And he knew my background. He had read my papers. You know, I have, genotype, phenotype, a lot of skills related to different biological organization. And I said, well, what do you have in mind? He said, well, why don't you come up and do a postdoc with us, a fellowship, and do risk assessment? And I was like, well, okay, you know, that sounds okay. It's in Cincinnati. Well, I tell my wife, do you mind moving to Cincinnati? No, we're not moving to Cincinnati. Well, at that time, no kidding, I was only making about $27,000 as an academic postdoc. I essentially tripled that by accepting an ORISE fellowship in the US EPA. And so in January of 2005, I started at the US EPA, and the different look was is that I no longer am doing the bench research science to develop the data. Rather, I am integrating all the data that we have available for a given compound, whether it's in the water, air, soil, and trying to understand, does anybody know who that is? This is kind of a trick question. Farm Talks people, he's the godfather, really. Paracelsus, I'll get to his quote in a minute. It's important for any tox person in here. But I said, what in the world is human health risk assessment, John? And he said, well, you know, we deal with air and water and soil, and, you know, there's all these chemicals in there, and they occur as mixtures, and we have no idea what some of them do. Why don't you come up and help us out? Okay. Where does my skill set fit in, John? You've read my papers. You know my background. He said, well, you know, you've really worked hard on, you know, learning toxicogenomics and its relationship to phenotypic changes in tissues. Just come up and give it a try. Why not? Well, it is, I'm not kidding you, it's a very fundamental science, risk assessment, okay? It is hazard identification, which really equates to what should we be most worried about among all effects in a given organism, whether it's fish or humans, and I happen to just work with human health risk assessment, but you can't be a one-trick pony. I'm a hepatologist, gastroenterologist by training, but you have to know about lung, spleen, kidney, blood, skeletal muscle changes. So a systemic physiologist would be a killer risk assessor, okay? Now, what should we be worried about? That's the qualitative aspect. More importantly is the quantitative, and that is, what is the dose response related to such an effect? And Paracelsus, long time ago, actually his name was, I think, Philip von Hohenheim from Austria, he coined the term, all things are poison and nothing is without poison, only the dose permits something not to be poisonous. Really rings true, because in human health risk assessment, everything is a poison at the right dose, okay? Now, one aspect that's critical, this is called the risk assessment paradigm, hazard ID, dose response assessment, exposure assessment. We have an entire part of the EPA that works on this part. I happen to work on this part. We all feed into something called risk characterization, which is what you read about in the newspaper whenever we figure out what in the world is actually in those dispersants that they put in the Gulf. So, to be continued. So hazard identification, really this is fundamental stuff and what I work on. Is it a toxicant? What does it do? What are the tissues and systems that they actually act on? Under what conditions, durations? So whether it's like a short-term occupational exposure or long-term, I've been drinking the same tap water for 9 years. What routes of exposure? Things, the same compounds can act a little bit differently depending upon the exposure route, so inhalation or oral. Or even dermal. The quality of the data and the weight of the evidence and the various sources, these are very important for what I do, because we will use anything we can get our hands on, okay? Anything is better than a zero. And what I mean by that is that the people in the field who actually are doing the cleanup remediations depend upon us to give them the cleanup values to say how clean is clean, whatever the environmental media is. So if we have compounds that they really want to know something about and there's basically no data, we have to give them something. And so when I say various sources, human data is the golden goose. A lot of times we don't have it. We primarily rely upon animal data, whether it's monkeys, rabbits, mice, rats. So we have to use that type of information to come up with weight of evidence. This is qualitative, okay? So we need to be worried about the kidney. The dose response part is very straightforward. But what I want to bring your attention to is the level of biological detail of the data we typically have to work with. So it's clinical chemistry endpoints. It's relative and absolute organ weight changes. It's histological observations. Now, well, where's the toxicogenomics and proteomics and metabolomics? Okay? It's coming. It's not. This is applied toxicology right now in the EPA, but the paradigm's getting ready to change. I'll say modify, not change, but modify. I'm going to skip this. Really, this is what we give the people in the field, non-cancer, cancer effects. So for any given compound, does it cause cancer? Yes or no. Does it cause non-cancer? Yes or no. These are weight of evidence based upon different levels of data. Do we have human? Yeah, that's great. Do we have animal? Probably. If we don't have either of those, we'll use quantitative structure activity relationships and other predictive tox methods. To include toxicogenomics, which is what I'm getting ready to get into. and it applies to you all sitting out there as well as myself. Future considerations of the risk assessment paradigm, so hazard ID and dose response. The level of biological organization that we work with right now is pretty fundamental, very macro level, phenotypic. If imagine how long it takes to investigate one compound, because we usually need for a cancer assessment, we need at least a 2-year rodent bioassay. Oh, so 1 minute? Good, I'm gonna roll. Okay, so it cost hundreds and thousands of dollars for companies and private organizations, the National Toxicology Program, to generate the type of data we need to do our job in the assessment arena. And as you can see, in 2007, David Dix said, well, there's greater than 10,000 chemicals in need of evaluation. Currently, we have just over 500 assessments publicly posted on the internet for the world to use. So we're way behind. Imagine how long it takes and the resources you need to get the information to come up with to tell the people in the field how clean is clean. Don't worry about this pie chart. We have a lot of chemicals. The European Union, okay, came out with legislation about the same summer. I think it was 2007. It's called REACH, Registration Authorization of Chemicals. They basically, it's backed by law over there. Wow, am I out? Wow. Okay. It's backed by law. Basically, they have to come up with ways to say what is hazardous and at what dose or concentration, but they don't have the time to do all the animal studies needed. So what can we do in lieu of that? Basically, high throughput, okay? Toxicogenomics, proteomics, metabolomics. If it says omics, we'll consider it. So the only problem is that the speed with which you can get that information is great, but the relevance to humans is not so great, okay? So there's an inverse relationship here. But I will say that instead of doing a 2-year rodent bioassay to get the tumor incidence data, that maybe you can do short-term assays in lesser animals at the same concentrations and get the information you need to prioritize and maybe get relative potencies for those compounds and say, boy, I bet this thing would be tumorigenic in the nasal turbinates of a human or of a rat. Real quick, these are the last couple slides. National Academies of Science put out a paper back in 2007. Everything I just said is on here. Instead of regulating, they see that in the future, instead of regulating on these macroscopic level changes, rodent assays won't ever go away. We're just saying reduce, okay? That's what they're saying. And rather look at pathway perturbations, whether it's at the genomic level or epigenetic level in signal transduction. I was hired on full-time in 2007. Challenges, balancing science with science policy. Empirical data versus what you're being told to think about the empirical data. And what I mean by that is that the perspective is different dependent upon the end use of that information. I can talk about that during the question and answer session if you want to. Finding time to publish is hard, to be honest with you. Staying on top of the most recent scientific issues. Advantages, job security. If I do the work, I can stay as long as I like. Wow. Basically, what I'm saying is if you work hard at the EPA, they're going to keep you. What I like most about my job is that I'm exposed to a bunch of very different skill sets, epidemiologists, statisticians, ecologists. The work products have immediate impact. Remember my original long-term goal? I want to help people. Well, I don't do it in a clinic. I actually do it at my desk. And this is truly applied toxicology. Setting yourself up for success, it's everything you all have already heard today. Participate, be proactive, seek collaborations, network, serve the science, okay? Get your name out there. For students, you know what your goal is to get your PhD. Be smart about your short-term goals, okay, how to get there. For postdocs looking for a job, your interim goal is not to be a postdoc. You need a job. So the key point for postdocs is make the hard choices. Determine now, do I want to stay in the academic track? Do I want to go to pharmaceutical industry or chemical manufacturing? Or do I want to go the government route? Make the hard choice, set the plan, and start the execution phase. And network hard. And I'll leave that up there for just a second. Basically, this is for all jobs for where Patrick works, where I work, and you name it, FDA, DOD. And postdoctoral fellowship opportunities are at that one with the EPA. Thank you.